in free market principles to save the free market system.
In a world of conventional confusion,
there will be time for them to make profits. Now's not that time.
Daddy, what do taxes pay for?
Oh, why everything. Policemen, trees, sunshine. And let's not forget the folks who just don't feel like working, God bless them.
Don't be afraid of your freedom.
Prepare to unshackle your mind.
An idea whose time has come cannot be stopped by any army or any government.
Your professor has arrived. Tom Woods. Beware, citizen. You are now departing from the world of allowable opinion. The Tom Woods Show.
Welcome, everybody. It's Friday, May 2nd, 2014. And I'm very glad to tell you that Bill Kaufman is joining us once again today. This time, we're going to talk about his new film, which, after its run in theaters, is now out on DVD, and that's Copperhead, directed by the great Ron Maxwell. Bill is the author of numerous books. We've talked about some of them in the past. His most recent book is Bye Bye Miss American Empire. And I can't really tell you what it's like to read a Bill Kaufman book. You just have to do it yourself. You have to do it. You have to experience it yourself. He writes like no one else in the world. Now, that doesn't have to be a compliment, by the way. That can be a terrible put down. But actually, he is an extraordinarily great writer. I absolutely love reading Bill Kaufman's writing. I may have said on this program before that there are a handful of people whose writing I genuinely envy. And Bill is one of those people. Bill Kaufman, welcome back to the Tom Woods Show.
Thanks, Tom. It's terrific to be here.
Bill, you may not know this, but the response from my listeners to your last appearance was just overwhelming. And the consistent response I got was, I was unfamiliar with Bill Kaufman before, and shame on me, but I love this guy. Like, I can't believe how much I love this guy. So,
really? To know him is to love him, right?
That's right. That is right. That's what I tried telling them, you know, that the response you're having is the perfectly human response when first encountering Bill Kaufman. So I thought I'd have you back, Bill, especially because it's an especially auspicious moment to do so, because the Copperhead film that you played such an intimate role in is now available on DVD. I thought it might be nice to talk about that. So let's start off by, I mean, this movie has Peter Fonda in it. Ron Maxwell of Gods and Generals fame is the director. This is a big deal. How did this project get started? You just happened to know Ron Maxwell?
Well, I did. You know, the odd thing is I did. You know, as you mentioned, Ron is probably the foremost cinematic interpreter of the Civil War with Gettysburg and Gods and Generals, these two big-scale epic films. I've known him for years, and we happened to be we were having breakfast like 4 or 5 years ago, and the night before he had spoken to the New Canaan Historical Society, and I was up there because we had another project we were working on that an abortive project someday may be revivified. But someone had asked him, "Hey, when are you going to make another Civil War movie?" And he replied, you know, I'd love to. I'm always looking for a topic, maybe something offbeat. The next morning at breakfast, I said, "Hey, you ever read this novel, novella, Copperhead?" He said, "Oh, it's a fantastic book." And it was born there. The Copperhead was written by Harold Frederick, who is now a forgotten name in American letters. But at one point was considered one of the major American novelists. He was born in Utica, which I think is the literary capital of New York State. You know, certainly, you know.
Next to Batavia.
Yeah, well, of course. So that's an exception. But pound for pound, Utica, far more impressive than that city down there on the Hudson at the bottom of the state.
You're well right.
Frederick had been a boy during the Civil War, living upstate New York, which was an area that, as Edmund Wilson said, was marked by a peculiar mixture of patriotism and disaffection. I think it's accurate to say that per capita we sent more boys to the Union Army than any other region of the country, and yet it was also a hotbed of anti-war, or maybe not even so much anti-war, but anti-Lincoln sentiment. We elected a Democrat governor in 1862, Horatio Seymour, largely on the civil liberties issue. And so Frederick had an odd life. He was a Jefferson, old-fashioned Jeffersonian Democrat. He was a friend of Grover Cleveland, Uncle Jumbo, over there in Buffalo. He was the London correspondent for the New York Times for a number of years. He died very young and under odd circumstances. It actually turned out he was a bigamist, and he was had two families in London, and he was with the. He was staying with the Christian Science wife when he had a stroke, which was really a piece of bad luck. he was not treated.
Oh.
She was tried for manslaughter. So he died scandalously. And his works were forgotten. But then they were... one of the books, The Damnation of Theron Ware, F. Scott Fitzgerald called the best American novel written before 1920. So he's not totally forgotten. But in the 1960s, the literary critic Edmund Wilson, also a native of the area around Utica, revived Frederick's Civil War stories. They came out in a new edition. And these stories are unlike any other Civil War stories in that they're about the home front in rural New York State. They don't have any Southern Dixie romanticism, nor do they have any Northern battle hymn of the Republic triumphalism. Righteousness. I mean, there are stories about little communities and the ways these communities are changed and altered irreparably when young men are removed from the communities, you know, and so some will return home intact, some will come home in pine boxes, some will come home changed for the worse, and some you never know what happens to them. So these little hamlets, you know, these interdependent communities of small farms and crossroads businesses, little Protestant churches, are shattered by the war. You know, and that's an aspect of war that our artists have tended to ignore, the domestic consequences. And that's what Frederick's stories are about, and that's what The Copperhead is about. And that's one thing that I think really attracted us to the story.
Well, as you said when I interviewed you about this around the time the movie was coming out in theaters, I talked to you about it when I was filling in for Peter Schiff, I noted that there's a speech in it, that not a speech, but a small soliloquy, let's say, delivered by the protagonist where he's speaking to the Peter Fonda character. And in this, he's defending himself because the protagonist is not in favor of the war. He'd like to see peace reestablished. And there are some people who find this hard to understand. We're fighting for the Union. Don't you value the Union? And he basically says, look, there's so many things I value more than I value the Union. And he looks at his friend and he says, you know what? I value you more than I value the Union. And it was this whole thing about preferring things that are close and tangible to things that are distant and abstract. And as we were watching it, I turned to my wife and said, Bill wrote that speech. There's no question in my mind. That's Bill Kaufman through and through.
we try to avoid. I hate message movies. You know where they pound you.
Oh, it's
head.
They're the worst, right?
Yeah, and this is not at all. This is not at all a message film. But if I confess that I did write a little soliloquy.
But I will say, in your defense, though, it's not John Galt's 40-page speech.
we should probably explain to the listeners that the very term copperhead was the derisive serpentine epithet applied to those Northerners who were against the war. And the copperhead of our film is a small farmer in upstate New York, an old-fashioned Jeffersonian Democrat. He's certainly not pro-slavery. Most copperheads weren't, although, obviously in the southern parts of Indiana, Ohio, you had a lot of people who were socially very close to the South, had family ties there. And a lot of those people were, you know, say, indifferent to the suffering of black bondsmen and bondswomen. That was not the case in upstate New York. There, the opposition tended to be, you know, based more, it was centered largely in, old-fashioned constitutional Democrats. Whether they were right or wrong or misguided or prescient is for the viewer to decide. But anyway, the war comes, and even though the war's far away, the war comes home, as it always does. This formerly substantial man of the community is ostracized, made a pariah. His son ends up running off to join the Union Army, so his family is riven, much as the community is riven. And thereupon unfolds a tale of recovery and redemption and violence and vengeance and the salvific properties of love.
Yeah, there is a moment in the film that I won't give away in which something happens that is entirely shocking, that you can see maybe the film is building to it. You know there's tension in the town. You know that people don't much care for this guy's political views. But then something happens that is just so jarring that you just sit right up and pay attention. But you know, Bill, let me change my line of discussion here, because I want to tell you that what impresses me about this is that it's not difficult to put together a Civil War movie in the sense that you have a ready audience for it. People eat it up. People love that era. People can't get enough Civil War movies. But they expect them to follow a certain line. They expect it either to be a military film, which this is not, or they expect it to repeat the standard pieties about the war that we've all imbibed. And yours throws them a curveball.
It does. And in that sense, it's subversive, I would say. But also, if there's any kind of political message to the film, I mean, other than Love Thy Neighbor, which is as radical a message now as it was, you know, a couple thousand years ago, but it would be about tolerating dissent. Now, movies or plays, you know, pieces of art about dissent, they always, I think, flatter the author and they flatter the audience.
Yeah.
Because, of course, all right-thinking people are on the side of the dissenter.
Right.
You know, who's being persecuted by the narrow-minded peasants or the clerics who deny that the Earth is round or that it orbits the sun or that there's such a thing as evolution. And it's just such a cheap and easy pose to stand at this distance of time with Galileo.
Yeah, I know, right.
Or Scopes, or the Witches of Salem. Oh, you're against witch burning.
Yeah, you know? I know you're against. Boy, what moral courage you've shown today in 2014 to be against witch burning.
Exactly. But, you know, in our film, you know, the protagonist, in a sense, so he's in many respects a flawed man, is standing up, speaking against the war, which is now hallowed. He's a critic of Lincoln, who I think by most 21st century lights is the greatest American hero. So it makes it more difficult. You know, okay, Mr. Free Speech, Mr. Oh, I'm for the First Amendment. Oh, I may disagree with what you say, but I defend to the death your right to say it. Are you gonna stand with this man? You know, who's taking on, you know, probably the most hallowed, you know, cause in American history, the Civil War. It makes it much more difficult, and I think it introduces a lot of complexities into it, you know? His chief antagonist, G. Hagedorn, who's brilliantly played by Angus McFadden, and I should say Ebner's played by Billy Campbell, in really powerful, understated performance. You know, Hagedorn is an abolitionist. And so he is, I think, unquestionably right on the central moral question of the age, the immorality of slavery. You know, I mean, the great big failing of this country was the failure to have, you know, liberated the slaves not only many decades earlier, but also peacefully. And yet, Hagedorn, the abolitionist, is also a fanatic. And like any fanatics, political fanatics, religious fanatics, he subordinates personal relationships and the things nighest unto him to a cause, and that cause eventually becomes an abstraction.
Yeah.
So he becomes the kind of guy, he can only see a forest. He can't see the individual trees. Now, again, in a conventional film, Hagedorn should have been impeccable, you know, and Ebner Beach, the anti-war guy, should have had a snidely whiplash mustache, and he should have kicked the dog, and he should have been smoking cigarettes and whatever other signifiers you have now of a villain. But that's not the case in this film, and I think it, to me, or in the story upon which it's based, and that's one of the things that that I think makes it, you know, something that, you know, people, when they see, I think, you know, most are affected by and talk about it. And certainly Abner Beach is not flawless, because he, I mean, he suffers also in a sense from Hagedornism, and then he, too, comes to subordinate his family to the personal cause, the anti-war cause. And so it's kind of a complex film, I think, and we're proud of it.
But Bill, what was...
It didn't exactly set the box office on fire, but it played in about 100 cities, and now it's on DVD and Blu-ray, and should be in your friendly neighborhood video store, or even better, you can buy it.
Yeah, you can buy it, and you can make both of us happy. If they buy it from Amazon through the widget on my show site, you help me stay on the air to promote Bill Kaufman. So,
oh, that would be that. Yeah. I can't imagine a better act that a person could commit.
Yeah, there it is. I mean, although the idea of Bill Kaufman ordering something from Amazon is a bit mind, you know, spinning here. But
I always do that. I always, like, even I have a little website, and I always say, please, you know, if you can, order from the local guy, but. If Amazon's the only source, well, hey.
Yeah, well, it's helped. The affiliate program helps me pay for some work that I sometimes need done on the show and all that. Now, let me ask you, what was your exact role in the film? Did you adapt the screenplay from the original work?
Yes, I did. I wrote the screenplay, so it was an adapted screenplay, and Ron Maxwell, the director, was a tremendous guide and mentor. So yeah, I was the screenwriter, and we follow the novella somewhat closely. Although actually about halfway through we branch off. The book ends very, very badly. I don't know what happened. Maybe he was tired. I have no idea. But yeah. So it's inspired by the book, largely based on the book. But if you read the novella, which I encourage folks to do. It's Harold Frederick, Frederic. There are a fair number of differences.
Where did you guys film it?
I was filmed up in, actually in, where, of course, we'd expect an American Civil War movie to be filmed, in Canada.
Oh, that's funny. I didn't realize that. Why?
Yeah, I was hoping it would be filmed in, actually, in a historical site in upstate New York, but for tax reasons, it was filmed in the province of New Brunswick. Actually, for more than tax reasons, they filmed it at a place called King's Landing, which is a treasure of Canada. It's a living history museum where the architecture and layout is mid-19th century North American. So it was the perfect spot to film, and it's a fantastic set. They tell me it would cost, you know, $30 million to build a set like this, but it was there for us to use.
Wow, beautiful. Well, you can't argue with that.
Although the funny thing is, the last minute, maybe 2.5 months or so before the film was released, the producers, who were just fantastic people, and they said, you know what, we need a brief scene at the beginning of the film. And so that's actually the one scene that I did not write. Ron wrote it, and it's the very first scene in the movie. And it was filmed, since you can't really film anything in, you know, the Maritime provinces in early March, it was actually filmed in Southern California, doubling for upstate New York.
How about that?
But you can't see any palm trees or anything like that in the background.
Ah, that's funny. You know, YouTube has this channel where, when they have huge movies that come out, this channel puts out everything wrong with such and such movie. And it finds all the anachronisms, and the guy's wearing three pens in his pocket in one shot, and then the very next shot he's got only two. And mercifully, you will not be subjected to that. I think that they would have spotted the palm tree, that's for sure.
They would have, yeah. And I hope they won't find too many anachronisms. I mean, the biggest anachronism usually in a historical movie is, again, the author doesn't want to be thought to in any way share the social conventions or whatever of the time. So there's always this auctorial alter ego. So you have a movie like set in the 1830s, but you'll have a female character who has the attitudes of a 21st century screenwriter.
Yeah.
You know? And that's, I mean, that to me is a decent anachronism.
Oh, yeah, yeah. And you know what? When I think about, for example, Amistad, which I guess there are courtroom scenes, and they're in Connecticut, and there are black people sitting there in the courtroom, you know, observing the trial, which goes to show they are more interested in political correctness than they are in really showing what conditions were like. You think black people would be allowed in a courtroom in Connecticut? There's no way, right? But of course, we have to make it seem like these were the good guys, and you know, there were some good guys, yes, but you can't pretend that society was a way that it wasn't, unless you just want to use the North, you know, against the traditional foil of the South, thinking of them as these gigantic blobs, these gigantic aggregates that have no actual people in them.
Right, right, and so all the complexity and contradiction gets washed out. You know, I mean, the Unionists in the South, the anti-war folks in the North. I live about 20 miles north of what was really the cradle of political abolitionism in America, Warsaw, New York, where the Liberty Party was formed. And these were, to me, these were some of the great heroes of American history. I mean, they wanted to. You know, they took a very unfashionable position,
yeah.
And they were motivated by, I think, Christian concerns, and they had a two-prong approach: moral persuasion and the enactment of personal liberty laws, which I know you've written about, Tom, and you know, which were essentially defying the Fugitive Slave Act.
Yeah,
you know, and this was one of the strategies to end slavery peacefully.
And they got about, as a party, they got about 2% of the vote. And this is why, Bill, it particularly sticks in my craw when today, especially among libertarians who are dying to let the establishment know that, I mean, we favor free trade and low taxes, but please, please don't call me an extremist, oh good New York Times reporter, sir. I want you to know that I hold all the fashionable opinions on everything, and I am deeply opposed to slavery. And these other libertarians, I think secretly they support it because they've said unkind words about Lincoln. But I'm really against slavery. And again, what possible courage? So what I've sometimes said, Bill, is that I consider it exceedingly unlikely, given that 2% of the vote went to the Liberty Party 150 years ago. I consider it exceedingly unlikely that people today who devote themselves to assuring everybody that they hold all the officially approved opinions would have been among that 2%. In that day, they would have been assuring everybody they hold the officially approved opinion that they're, of course, opposed to the Liberty Party and the extremists who belong to it.
Right, anathematizing Bernie and Garrett Smith and all these, I think, really heroic figures.
Now, Bill, were you actually on set when they were filming?
Yes, I was. They filmed for about 7 weeks. I was there for about off and on for about 4 weeks. There's not, on the set of a well-planned movie, there's not a whole lot for a writer to do, but once in a while, you know, they'd say, hey, you know, we just need a little transition scene here for tomorrow. And I had a little cubby hole, and it was fun because it was from like a 1930s movie, you know, Get Me Rewrite. And I get in there and pound out the scene. I was really impressed by the competence, you know, and the dedication of these crews are phenomenal. You know, I mean, it's a really complicated undertaking with many, you know, in the hundreds of parts to put one film together. But this worked very well, and it was I think it shows on the screen. I liked the film a lot. So,
you know, Bill, I was asking not so much because it hadn't occurred to me that there would be need, let's say, for an impromptu drafting of a short scene, but just that this was in some ways your baby, having done the screenplay, and it just might be fun to go and observe it, whether or not they really needed you there.
Oh yeah, absolutely, it was. And I think a lot of stories, writers tend to be whiners, as you know, Tom.
I refuse to believe that.
I think people who write films sometimes, can you hear, I've heard a number of horror stories about how all these vulgar, you know, Philistines, you know, ruin my vision, etc. But in this case, you know, Ron Maxwell and, you know, the cast and crew, I think, I mean, I can't imagine it having turned out better. You know, I mean, there might be one or two little things where, you know, I wish this scene stayed and I wish this scene didn't, but I can't complain. It was a, it was a great experience.
Well, I hope people will check it out. You can get it wherever, but it's called Copperhead. It's on DVD as of right now and Blu-ray, so there's no excuse not to be watching it. Bill, I'm looking forward to when your next book comes out, so we'll have another excuse to get you back on here. But as always, it's a pleasure chatting. Thanks for doing it.
It was a delight talking to you, Tom, and I hope everyone has a good day.
All right, everybody, keep your fingers crossed. Keep your fingers crossed, because on Monday, I should be making an announcement about how finally you can get the ebook that I've been promising of transcripts from all the interviews from 2013. I've had that book ready for quite some time, but I'm also trying to launch something else, a way for you to get transcripts of all the interviews. Because right now I have transcripts of every single interview we've ever done on the show. Now, the ebook is just for 2013. I've got transcripts of every single interview, and it's time-consuming because I don't do the transcripts myself. I hire transcriptionists, but even still, the best transcriptionist needs to be edited because the spoken word needs to be lightly edited for readability. And also, there's going to be some inside baseball knowledge that no transcriptionist is going to have. So I've got to go over them, and boy, has this been time-consuming. But I thought this would be useful, so I'm going to let you know also how you can get the rest of the transcripts. Get all the 2013 ones for free in that ebook, and then I'll let you know how you can get the rest of them. So let's hope. I mean, cross your fingers here. It's just been a couple of things with some web developers getting this thing ready for me, but the ebook has been ready for some time thanks to some wonderful people at elance.com that I hired to put it together for me. So keep your ears peeled for this on Monday. And when that does come out, I hope you will link to it everywhere. Tell all your friends. This is a wonderful way to spread the word about the program. I'm looking over the list of shows that we've done, and I'm really thrilled with it. I just can't get over what a variety of subjects we've been able to cover. And I'm really, really grateful for all the people who listen. I'm getting emails constantly, or when I go give talks around the country, people are coming up saying, I never miss an episode. And well, you know, maybe people are just saying that to make me feel better, but I don't think so. These people seem sincere to me. So I couldn't do it without you guys listening. I guess I wouldn't do it without you guys listening, but I appreciate the support. I appreciate everybody who is linking to the show, who's telling people about it on Facebook, spreading the word, because I've got some limited ways to promote the show myself. But I really, really rely on you guys to get the word out. I appreciate you doing that. All right, we'll see you all next week. That interview with Pat Buchanan on Winston Churchill is coming up next week. Stay tuned. We'll see you then.
The Tom Woods Show.